Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress that is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. It's a great mattress at a very reasonable price point. Comes with a 20-year warranty and a great deal for our listeners. Douglas is giving you a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand. Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures, and it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you.
Finally, before we start our show today, a few matters of business to talk about. The first is that I'm sure a lot of people are tuning in today to see if this episode will contain a response to Jean Gomeshi's essay in the New York Review of Books. I probably will tell you what I think about that essay eventually, but for now, I'm going to stick to what I know about that essay. Specifically, what I know is inaccurate, misleading, deceptive, or simply wrong about that essay. We have done a fact check, and the best way to present that is through an article, and that is posted on our website at canadalandshow.com. You can check that out right now. The next thing I want to tell you is that I am taking some time to complete work on our Thunder Bay investigative podcast along with Ryan McMahon and a team of people on that. So I will be taking off a number of Monday Canada Land shows for the next little while. And what we've done is we have hired a variety of incredible and surprising guest hosts to fill in for me. Today's episode will be hosted by a guy I knew as Steve Murray when he was working at the National Post, but he is known to hundreds of thousands, possibly millions more today as comic book writer and artist Chip Zdarsky. He was a guest of mine on Canada Land in the early days of this show, and frankly, I just have no idea how this is going to go down, but I am very excited to find out. I will be listening along with you, and I will be back on Thursday to talk about that essay and other things on Shortcuts.
Hi, I'm clearly not Jesse. You can hear my voice that I'm at least a foot shorter and far less wealthy. And I'm definitely not a professional podcast host. I'm actually a comic book writer and artist. My pen name is Chip Zdarsky, and I write Spider-Man for Marvel Comics, and I also illustrate a book called Sex Criminals, which isn't as bad as it sounds. It's about a couple who, when they have sex, time stops, and they rob banks. But before all of that weirdness, I was a journalist. My real name's Steve Murray, and I worked for the National Post for over a decade. My job was different. I did information graphics, cartoons, I even had an advice column. But when my comic career took off, I had to make a choice. So I jumped from one dying print industry into a totally different dying print industry. Except that's not exactly true. I mean, it is the way a lot of people think of the comic book industry in North America. A lot of you listening probably haven't picked up a comic book since you were a kid. And maybe you think they're just ancient fodder for the movies that dominate the box office globally. But really, in a lot of ways, they're thriving. Especially in Canada, which has tons of industry talent. It's a medium that keeps evolving, experimenting, and reaching different audiences. And look, I get it. The movies are super cool. But the heart of them are comics. Now, someone who's intimately familiar with this potential is my old friend Chris Butcher. He's basically Canada's ambassador for comics. I met him around 2000 when he worked for a Toronto institution, The Beguiling, the kind of comic shop that sold you your X-Men books, your Batman books, but also put a spotlight on comics that were artsier fare. Smaller, independent artists, comics from around the world, comics from right here at home featuring Canadian talent. They saw and treated comics as art. And that idea, comics as art, led Chris and The Beguiling to start the Toronto Comic Arts Festival, otherwise known as TCAF. It's an annual show that now ranks among the best comic festivals in the world. It's crazy. Huge. People come from around the globe to exhibit and attend. But it started off pretty small. I still remember selling my first books at a TCAF in 2003, where it was held in the parking lot of Toronto's premier kitschy discount store, Honest Ed's. So today, Chris and I are taking a look back at how far TCAF has come and its international impact on the industry, as well as the insane boom of comics across other mediums, Canada's place in it all, and how much better I am at this than Jesse. Wait for it. Or don't, I'm not the boss of you. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Jennifer Hollett, David Beers, Joseph Planta, Matthew Beckett, Matthew White, Jared Babin, David Backner, and Heather Farrell.
My name's Heather. I'm a speech-language pathologist in Toronto. I support Canada Land because high-quality journalism is vital to a healthy democracy, and sometimes you have to put your money where your mouth is.
This episode is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. Trust is important. There are a lot of mattress lies out there, a lot of mattress liars. And I didn't intend the pun, but it occurred to me that there is one as I was saying those words. Listen, I am not lying to you. I have experienced the Douglas mattress. It is an exceptional mattress at a surprisingly affordable price point. It is a mattress that sleeps cool, doesn't have that weird thing in the summer where the mattress gets like an oven. It's a very good product. It's delivered to your house in a box. You don't have to go to a big mattress store. It is a medium firm mattress, which is what Canadians prefer, and it comes with a 365-night trial and a 20-year warranty. What more can I tell you? Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. This episode is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We hear a lot about the opioid crisis. We talk a lot about the mental health crisis. These are serious problems. These problems affect us all. They've affected my life and my community. They are not intractable problems. I don't know what's going to solve them on a policy level, but day to day, helping people, that's what CAMH does. They do it on the ground when people need help, and they do it through research. The team at CAMH gave our team a tour of their facilities, and we were really just blown away by the incredible heroic work that they're doing every day. They treat everyone with dignity, and their research is seeking and finding real solutions for everyone around the world. Help change mental health care forever. Your support will help CAMH build a future where no one is left behind. Donate at CAMH.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope.
How did you get into comics? Were you a comic reader as a kid?
I was, actually. I was a young man of just 8 years old, yeah, and living in good old Malton, Ontario, and I was a huge fan of the Transformers, the cartoon show.
Yeah.
And then, on a fateful trip to Becker's, which I don't think exists anymore,
no,
I noticed that there was a Transformers comic book, and Transformers held no, like, comics didn't really hold any interest. My cousins were all older than me, and they'd show me, like, the Spider-Man cartoon show, the like, 70s one.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it would run on City TV, like, 24 hours a day, that and Hercules, as far as I remember,
yeah.
And Rocket Robin Hood.
Yeah.
And,
Made in Toronto. Shout out to all those programs.
Shout out. Yeah. Made in Toronto. And I was like, oh my God, there is more Transformers than the Transformers I have been allotted on TV by being this now. And that was it. From that point, I was just a huge Transformers comics fan. And then I sort of kept finding new stuff on the stands that was interesting. Buddies would be like, what do you mean you're not reading the X-Men? Like, are you some sort of baby that just reads Transformers? And I'm like, no, I'm a baby who also reads Transformers, but I will try your X-Men. I've been through all of these, like, grand awakenings, I guess, in comics, where you just like get introduced to whole new bits of the industry that are previously unseen, or maybe were just sitting in plain sight, but you weren't ready to see them, you know?
Yeah. So, but I mean, before the art comics awakening and the Beguiling came into the picture, like you worked at like a more of a standard comic book store, right?
Yeah. I worked at a comic shop in Brampton, which is still around, different owners now. Customers bought the store, which is just what happened with the Beguiling, actually.
Yeah. That happens a lot. Like there's another place in Stony Creek that same thing. Like I think the owner died and the customers got together and bought it.
Yeah. That's the comics retirement plan.
Yeah. That's the
comic shop
model.
Retirement plan. Yeah. You're going to die probably in the store. Yeah. And your customers are going to take it over for you. But yeah, Stadium Comics in Brampton. Like I was like 19, 20, 21. Going down to Toronto as often as I could, being super closeted, all that kind of stuff. And comics were like a nice escape for that.
So what was the difference for you between working at that comic shop and then the Beguiling?
I am a pretty adversarial person by nature. And I found, especially as the time went on in that comic shop, I was constantly fighting against like the owners, even let alone the readership and things like that. Like there's so much good work out there. Why is it we're only selling like the worst stuff to people? Why aren't they like willing to even try or even look at something else? And you know, it's comics as comfort for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Whereas being adversarial at the Beguiling and with the owner of the Beguiling, Peter Bercamo, was always rewarded. It's like, oh, you're going to challenge me. Well, here, that means I get to flex my muscles on you. And that was great. We had a great relationship pretty much from the first time I met him because of that. Like, yeah, like, fine, let's argue about this comic and its, you know, intrinsic value, or let's agree on this comic and its intrinsic value. But it doesn't mean we have to stop talking, which was great.
I mean, that was always kind of my favorite part about going into the Beguiling when I moved to Toronto. Like, I went to art school where they kind of told you to not do anything with comics. Like you were an illustrator for newspapers, magazines, but comic books were not a thing that was encouraged in school. So once I got out of school and into Toronto, I was like, well, maybe I should, you know, check out some comics. And Beguiling was kind of my main shop. And the difference between you and Peter and the floors of the Beguiling as well, like the main floor was Peter's domain, where it was like, his European comics and the independent art comics. And then the second floor was more of the superhero, the mainstream stuff. And also like you were introducing like the manga as well upstairs. I love that split. And there was kind of a tension between the floors. Like if you were buying the stuff upstairs, don't cash out downstairs because you're going to get looks.
Yeah, we used to get asked all the time when we were going to get an additional Visa MasterCard debit machine on the second floor so that people didn't have to go downstairs to check out because they didn't want their purchases judged. And I'm like, whatever, man, like what you like, but own it. Like own that you're reading trash. Like,
it's such a weird business. It's almost like going into like a porn shop or whatever and buying porn, and it's like this weird old lady behind the counter, like, oh, I can't believe you're buying this pornography. I'm like, well, you're selling me this pornography. But that's what made the Beguiling such an interesting place. And I think what has made TCAF such an interesting festival. So how did TCAF kind of come about from you working at the Beguiling then?
I had an idea for a comic show in Toronto with local talent that puts the spotlight on them and is more about comics and is less about what the sort of corporate shows are turning into, which is all kinds of pop culture bullshit.
Yeah.
And I pitched it to Peter, who runs the Beguiling, because I had no money. I had negative money at that point. And he's like, no, that's too much work. And he just disagreed. And then he was trapped in a car with me for 10 hours. And so I convinced him. Yeah. And then on the way there, we sort of agreed looked at the show we were going to take all the best ideas and figure out what we didn't want to do. And then on the way back, came up with the name, which was the Toronto Comic Arts Festival, working with Mark Nui and Marcel Goldemund. And, you know, just came up with the idea for this show that would be a little bit more European influenced, a little bit more thoughtful, which sounds really pretentious, I guess. But we really, really thought about why we wanted to do the show and what the show was supposed to be about. The one thing that didn't survive from that first year that we did was we charged admission on the first year. It was like $5, pay what you can at the door. And then from 2007 onwards, because we're doing it outside and in tents and stuff like that, we're like, well, we just got to make it free and we'll just eat that cost and try and find sponsors, or just the Big Island will pay way more money and that kind of thing.
How many people do you estimate came to the first TCAF?
600, I think we did. We had actual admissions for the first year, so it was 600 all told.
And how many people came this past year?
Over 25,000.
That's pretty good.
That was okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the reason we kept making it free, even after we could close doors, was the idea that if we're taking $20 or $30 at the door, or even $5, that's money that we're taking out of the pockets of people that are coming in to spend it on creators.
Yeah.
The whole point of the show is those creators, the people that are generating the work that allows us to have an industry in the first place.
So TCAF's grown kind of on the international scale.
Mm.
It's regarded as like one of the best shows in the world for comics now. Like, at least that's my perception of it. Have you seen the effect from TCAF, like what I was saying earlier, on other shows and other libraries?
We were the first show to have the TCAF, or the CAF Comic Arts Festival, branding, I guess, or the name for the festival, because we were trying to come up with what we wanted to call the show. And now I think there's 20 of them. The first one was one in Maine, MCAF. And we were like, oh, that's a little bit weird. Oh, okay, I guess that's happening. And now there's just like 24 of them. And it's...
And your lawyers are all over it, right?
Our lawyers are shutting down as many independent small comic shows as they can. No, it's nice. I wish that they all tried to adhere to the core values that we have, which is making the shows free.
Yeah.
I think that's really important. Trying to keep table costs as low as possible for participants. We're expensive, but Toronto is expensive, but we're still the cheapest of the shows that are in like our level, our class, which is nice. I want shows like TCAF to be about accessing the industry with as few barriers to entry as possible.
Yeah.
And that is something that people have found really internationally exciting.
Do you feel like TCAF's kind of affected the industry itself?
No, I don't think anything we do is ever going to have a positive impact in general, since you asked. I think the industry is bigger than us in a lot of ways. I think the best that we can do, we can ever hope for, is to create a positive environment for people by having them show up at the festival and encounter an audience that's got money, that's engaged, that's happy to be there, that's curious.
Now, ever since I've known you, we probably met like 2000, 2001.
Somewhere in there,
In the early days, you were quite a vocal critic of the comics industry.
Yes.
Like, you were kind of known for that.
When I was younger, I was very critical about comics. I was very critical about Marvel and DC especially, because they were the people that, again, working in comic book stores, most affected my livelihood as a 20-something-year-old. If Marvel had a bad month, my shifts got cut back. And I was critical because I saw things that I thought were plain and obvious that were wrong about the way they were doing business, about not just the stories that they were telling, but how they were marketing them and how they were packaging them, how they were making them available or not available to customers, how they were treating retailers that were selling their work, you know?
Yeah.
And I never stopped wanting things to change for the better. All my criticism was rooted in wanting positive change for the industry.
Yeah.
And all of my commentary, all of my criticism, all of my asshole-ishness had that as its core. I was mean, but it was because I could see something better and I wanted it and I could see the way to it and I couldn't get people on board. And at a certain point, I decided that I could write all the blog articles in the world about it, or I could just go and try and do something actually positive, like create something positive with TCAF and try and lead the way a little bit. But like, yeah. I was a colorist on an Image comic series called The Adventures of Evil and Malice, which was like a superhero series for girls.
Yeah.
And then I worked on Trina Robbins's Go Girl, which was a superhero comic series from Image Comics for girls, because no one was producing comics for girls in, you know, the 2000s. And both of them were huge flops. Retailers didn't order them. I had to convince my own boss to like order the books that I worked on so I could sell them to my friends. And he was like, it's not going to sell. And I'm like, my mom will come in and buy a copy. Order at least one for my mom.
Yeah.
Like that level of entrenchment of not wanting the industry to change, because change is scary. But yeah, like I want comics to be better. I believe that my impact is limited and everything I can do, if I do everything perfectly all the time, still not gonna right the ship or even steer it. But it's going to give everyone who's on the ship a better time.
What do you see are the problems right now? Have the problems changed since 2000 when you were first kind of talking about the situation with comics?
I think things are markedly better in every way except for Marvel and DC than they were in 2002. I think that you can have a career in comics and you can be fairly compensated for your work, and there are more people making their living as professional comics creators than there have been in like 50 years, maybe 40, 50 years.
Especially Canadians.
Especially Canadians, especially with the advent of the internet.
Yeah.
That's remarkable to me. There are more people reading comics than there have been in 30 or 40 years. And this is something that gets lost in all of the ridiculous comics bullshit that goes on the internet right now.
Yeah.
There are more people reading comics than there have been in almost any of our lifetimes, like us as, you know, crotchety old men now. That's awesome. Like, we got to live to see that and contribute to it.
Yet they still don't feel like they're big in popular culture, like as comic books. Like my parents have seen the Avengers movies, but they've never read any comics.
Your parents though are 20 years older than you even. And it's generational. My brother has 5 children. Every single one of them grew up reading comics. And it's not just me and Andrew buying them comics and books for every single birthday and Christmas. It is literally, they're in schools. They're getting the Scholastic Book Club flyers and going to book fairs and going to the bookstore. And there are huge book sections that have comics in them.
Yeah, there seems to be a shift. Like even me talking about when I went to college for illustration, and them, like, you know, being negative about comics as a career. Now they're inviting myself, Jeff Lemire, Ramon Perez, Keegan McLeod to come and like talk about comics to the class. Like, they've figured out that there's something there. And I think also adults, teachers, librarians have figured out a thing that I knew even as a kid, which is that comics are a great way to introduce somebody to reading.
Oh, yeah.
Like having the pictures married to the words, like, helps you understand the words so much better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're a great way to introduce. And the what gets tossed around a lot is gateway. They're a gateway to reading.
Yeah.
No, they are reading.
Yeah.
Like, they are not just like starter readings that you switch to novels right away. Comics are their own language. You got me all headed up now. Hepped up. This is a thing that really bothers me a lot, is that people like talk about like, oh, and comics are great for getting people like introduced to reading.
Yeah.
As long as they then go on to read like real books. And it's like, comics are real books. Graphic novels are real books. And we have to have a discussion about that.
Yeah. So in Canada, there is the, you know, the recognized CanLit.
Yeah.
But graphic novels, comics don't ever seem to be a part of that. Like, is that a good thing or a bad thing? I mean, CanLit can have baggage associated with it.
Can have.
Can have. Does have. But also there's like a sense of community that comics are kind of outside of. Like, comics has its own community. CanLit has its own community. Like,
comics just had to forge its own way for a long time, though.
Yeah.
Like, comics got used to being the badass outsider, and just like
with the leather jacket popped up. Yeah.
We're comics. We're over here. We're cool.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think the best example of this is when Jeff Lemire with his Canada Reads situation for
Essex County
trilogy, where it was picked as a Canada Reads book, and like the first judge is like, this isn't even really a book, it's a comic.
Yeah.
First off, fuck that person.
Yeah, fuck that person.
Secondly, you know what? Fine. If you don't want to embrace this amazing work that talks about Southern Ontario as like a Southern Canadian Gothic work, that's fine. It's just going to go on to keep selling tens of thousands of copies as you guys turn your noses up at it.
It's funny, the CanLit always makes me think of, it was a couple years ago when they had, it was like a book fair or something at the convention center. Like,
oh, yeah, yeah. I remember
the first shot of that.
Inspire.
Yeah, yeah.
Inspire the book fair.
I was brought in to kind of talk at a breakfast about comics publishing.
Oh.
And it was for like publishers and stuff, mostly Canadian in the crowd, you know, having their continental breakfast.
I heard. Yeah, okay. I apologize for any role I played in that, but go on.
No, no, no. It was fine. I had a good time, but I could see jaws drop when I talked about the numbers of comics.
Sales figures.
Sales figures and the reach of Sex Criminal specifically.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I remember talking to like the books editor at National Post, and he was like, you know, 5,000 copies is a hit in Canada.
It is.
And I'm like, well, like Sex Criminals, like we've sold many more copies than that.
How many more?
A lot more. And it didn't really click until that moment when I started talking about like the behind the scenes counting of everything and the reach of comics for the most part. It made me feel like comics are quite healthy, but I'm also like, well, like it's so weird that we're so outside of this.
I think everyone is asking themselves that same question.
Yeah.
Everyone, I will say maybe in the graphic novel boom, like 5-10 years ago, mm-hmm. Most of the Canadian publishing houses went and started acquiring in a real way.
Yeah.
Groundwood, House of Anansi. Mm-hmm.
It's so funny, the idea that comics are like, yeah, there's more people reading them than ever. The manga boom was, I think, super beneficial for me.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Because now that, yeah.
Sex Criminals, which is a story about relationships and sex and a little bit of sci-fi there.
Yeah.
We didn't think it would have an audience, but then we noticed at comic conventions, it was almost all 20-something, maybe early 30 women. And it felt to me, in conversations with them, that it was like they'd read all the manga.
Yeah.
They grew up reading all of it, and they were just kind of like running out, and they were primed for something in North America that would speak to them. Well, and I feel like it's a market that still hasn't, I don't think North American creators have quite noticed that yet.
None of them read manga. That's a really interesting thing where there are maybe like two or three creators that I talk to that have read manga in the last year. So right now, the most popular superhero comic book in North America is a Japanese manga called My Hero Academia.
Yeah.
It's about a school for gifted youngsters learning to use their superpowers and become superheroes. And it is gripping, and it is insanely popular, and no one in the superhero sphere is talking about it.
Because no, I mean, I'll admit it, I haven't read it.
It's great. It is exactly what you want a comic for young people to be.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, comics that Marvel and DC are producing are not comics for young people for the most part.
No, I mean, the problem I find working for Marvel, DC, like being within that kind of realm.
There are problems working for Marvel and DC.
You're right. It's perfect. Is the fact that it's a continued narrative of 60 years.
Yeah.
And because of that fact, I have to acknowledge that and create stories that tie into 60 years worth of narrative. And also the readers have like stuck around for that long, maybe not 60 years, but like you're up against the expectations of many different generations and their understanding of the characters.
Yeah.
So it's very
really
hard.
Difficult because those books, in trying to appeal to everybody, appeal to no one. They are not for anybody.
That's the thing that like I'm always up against. I'm like, whenever I write a story for Marvel, I'm like, can this be picked up by somebody and understood on its own?
Yeah.
And also provide like a hit of like continuity for the reader who's been picking it up for 20 years.
Yeah.
And that's hard. Like you can, the day it was announced that I was writing Spider-Man, I got maybe a dozen messages to like my Tumblr account from people telling me how to write Spider-Man.
Oh, of course.
Like basically being like, congratulations on your new job writing Spider-Man. I think you'll agree with me. The last 10 years of stories have not been very good. And that this is what has to happen for it to be better. And in their examples, I could always pinpoint how old they were when they were reading the comic when they were a kid, because that's what they imprinted on. Yeah. And that's what they've carried with them.
Mm.
And it's hard. Like a lot of the things that I kind of push when I'm at Marvel in the offices is the idea of kind of like redoing it all, like starting fresh, like creating different lines of books. You know, you can still have the recognition of the character, but you can divorce yourself from the continuity and get them into the hands of kids. One of the other things that I find interesting is because at Marvel, we're all inside Marvel. Like, we grew up reading it and we kind of know these stories so well. Like, Marvel sometimes has a problem hitting the younger market. And I'm like, well, yeah, because your characters all punch each other. Like, I think librarians and teachers now, more than when I was a kid, they look at stuff like that and being like, well, no, we can't have that. Like, these characters are using violence to solve their problems.
I don't encounter that in my day-to-day when I'm dealing with teachers and librarians, which actually happens, like, an awful lot.
Yeah. So I should have more punching in my comics?
I think this is not necessarily the punching, but, like, we call it the, like, single panel problem, where if you have a parent or a librarian or a teacher, but it's usually not librarians or teachers because those are people that have been educated to value books that have controversy in them. Usually if you have a parent who wants to hold up a book and go, this panel is inappropriate. If you freeze framed about, I could think of like 20 scenes in the first season of Riverdale alone and put that in a page in a book and had a parent holding that up, you could never get away with it. You could never do a Riverdale comic book.
It's not just pulling out the panel. Like, when I worked at the National Post, I did a comic where I went to Wicked, the swingers club.
I remember that.
I did a comic about going there because they had like a film fest party there. And one of the panels had the owner and his wife grinding on the hood of a car that was also a DJ booth. But I got in trouble, and I got called into the editor-in-chief's office the next day because they were putting, they had a program where like National Post went into schools and they had complaints from, I don't know if it was parents or teachers. And he was like, you've gone too far this time. I'm like, what are you talking about? And he pulled out the comic. He's like, what is this? Like, you know, you have like wiggle lines next to his butt. Like, the kids are reading this. And I'm just like, I read all your previous stories about this nightclub in which they mention like oral sex and like fornication, like in the stories. And like, this cartoon man is grinding. He's like, I know, but it's a comic.
Yeah.
So it's for kids. Mm-hmm. That's always the problem. Like, with that kind of like weird level of censorship.
But like, there's all kinds of other comics out there that like that are about interpersonal relationships, are about like problem solving through discourse and blah blah blah. Like,
I mean, the root of it is to make a thing you enjoy and have fun doing it, and also just to like stay away from being too up your own ass with the comic language of it all.
Sure,
because you know, you still want to be able to pass it to anyone and have them understand how to read it, like even just the ability to read a comic. Sometimes we take for granted.
My mom can't read comics, which is weird. My dad loves comics, but I've given her comics that have like a basic 6-panel grid where it's like 2 panels, 2 panels, 2 panels.
Yeah.
Can't read it. She doesn't even like reading comics in the newspaper because the comics are too close together, even though they're different, like daily newspaper strips. They're like, she just can't follow it in the same way that
she thinks Garfield
can.
Just leads directly into Kathy, like
directly into for better or for worse, and then directly into like BC, and you're like, wow, that got real conservative at the end actually. Like, anyway, at least they're praising Jesus. That's nice.
My kind of guiding principle working at Marvel, it came from Matt, the writer of Sex Criminals. He worked at Marvel for a long time, and the advice he gave me when I started at Marvel was, are you proud of the work and are you having fun? If like either of those things are happening, stick around. If both of those things are happening, great. If neither are happening, you should leave the book.
Yeah.
And that's basically what happened on Spider-Man. I think I just stopped having kind of fun on it. There wasn't any kind of sense of joy. And I was like, oh, if I'm not feeling that, then I'm not actually happy with what I'm producing, which means I've got to like mix it up. I've got to do something else.
Isn't that tempting to just stay on a book?
The 8-year-old in me was very angry that I quit Spider-Man because, like, what the fuck? You're writing Spider-Man. Like, don't leave.
Yeah.
And it was super tempting to stick around, but my own frustrations with my work on the book and the process of it just hit the point where I'm like, well, what are you doing? Like, do you want to be somebody that just does the book for the paycheck? Or do you want to do a thing that like feels like you're elevating it or like...
But that's a tremendously privileged position because that you could afford to grip that.
It is. And the privilege comes from Sex Criminals.
Oh, well, that's nice.
Because that's the thing. Like one issue...
The creator-owned book.
One issue of Sex Criminals pays me more than, I'm going to say, 20 scripts for Marvel.
20? 2-0?
Yeah.
Holy shit, Chip.
Like I don't have to work for Marvel. I want to work for Marvel for a few reasons. One, I've learned so much.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
It's an incredible, like, learning experience working on a monthly book.
How long do you want to do it for?
I'm on contract with Marvel for 2 years, and I just finished my first year. And part of the beauty of being on contract like that is I get invited to the retreats.
Oh, so, I know you like the Marvel retreats. What happens at a Marvel retreat?
Well, the NDA says I can't tell you, but I will tell you because this is just between us. You fly to New York once every like 3-4 months and you go to the Marvel offices and you basically are in this giant room with tables all around with people flown in from everywhere, creators, there's editors, there's people from video games or whatever. And you just talk about like stories for like 3 days.
That sounds fun.
Which is fun. It's also insanely stressful.
Oh, sure.
But yeah, it's a ton of fun. And
it's a bunch of people that are also doing your job. And you guys are all sort of basically dick measuring for 3 days. Like going, this is what I've got. And they're like, oh, interesting you would say that. Because actually, blah, blah, and I've got this.
The stories I've heard are that in the past, there's been a lot of that. Okay. I think the crew that's there now is kind of less so.
Okay.
Like everyone seems to be pretty friendly unless they're all like shit talking me behind my back.
Maybe.
But
you should really worry about that.
But part of the reason I signed up on the contract was because I like the idea of being in that room just to like experience it.
Yeah.
And I've done it like 3 times, 4 times.
So you're going to this thing and it's not about you guys collaborating. It's about you talking about your individual stories.
It's you present your stories. Mm-hmm. And then it's opened up to the room to like basically critique it. They'll suggest, you know, adding a thing if they have questions about it. Like, well, why would Captain America throw his shield at that guy? I don't know. It becomes a discussion in the room. And they're funny discussions because when you're talking about Wolverine amongst a bunch of like grown men in a boardroom, it's like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
It's like defending a thesis in a weird way.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I'm not a learned school man.
I mean, me either. Fuck it.
But from what I understand, you're basically throwing your thesis out there for Iron Man or whatever.
Yeah.
And then everyone questions your Iron Man pitch. Or they stand up and applaud you, which has never happened.
But how do you feel about being a Canadian creator? Like, do you feel othered?
Well, no. I mean, it's like you kind of said earlier about, you know, the internet kind of opening things up for everyone. Like, it's so much easier to, like, get work internationally. Like, a lot of the artists I work with at Marvel are worldwide. Like, I'm working with a guy who's from Italy, a guy who's from Spain right now. So, yeah, I mean, it doesn't make that much of a difference for me, but I think that's mostly because I'm kind of in the Marvel cog, which kind of makes me feel like I miss out a little bit. Like, you know, there's Drawn and Quarterly here, which, you know, I'd love to do something with them just because then I would be, you know, officially a Canadian comic book creator, like fully.
Sure.
And I think that's the thing. A lot of Canadian creators would like to work for Canadian companies if there were more Canadian companies.
Yeah.
Like some of the ones that have come and gone in the past few years have been like a little bit shady.
Sure.
I won't name any names.
Let's not name any names. Why kick them when they're already down?
Yeah, yeah, and that's...
And out, thankfully.
That's a little bit upsetting. Like, Koyama Press, like, you know, she's going to be kind of wrapping that up.
Yeah, it's the best.
Yeah.
She's the best. I'm sorry that she is wrapping things up.
Yeah, but I mean...
Like, I'm happy for her, but...
Yeah, I'm happy for her, but I'm also like, well, there's a void. Like, it seems like in Canada, there's a potential for more comic publishers that...
Oh, absolutely.
That just aren't, like, kind of, like, showing up.
I think... a publisher like Conundrum, who works pretty close with Koyama on a number of projects, is stepping up their game right now. They're publishing more books than ever.
Yeah.
And working at TCAF too, we get to see the like full range of like what graphic novels are. We as TCAF represent Canada abroad on the world stage. Our mandate is to invite the world to Toronto, to Canada, to see what we're doing here.
Mm-hmm.
And then send Canadians abroad to promote their work in different comics markets.
Yep.
So we do a trip to Japan every year, to Tokyo, to their sort of comic book events for overseas comics. This year we're doing an event, a partnership in Colombia. We did an exchange in Denmark that I'm going to Denmark next week.
Okay.
And, you know, we're doing these things. But people don't really understand, you know, in Denmark or in, you know, London or wherever, who is a Canadian creator or what qualifies a Canadian creator. And that's before you get into the very tricky and thorny issue of the fact that, like, Quebec has its own publishing industry that does not need English Canada, does not give a shit. They publish a ton of books. There's like seven Quebecois publishers, like Editions Pow Pow and La Pastèque and... Oh my God, there's so many more. Editions Trip in Quebec that are publishing French language books, occasionally English language book for a French audience in Quebec and in France. Like they get exported, they have international distribution. It's amazing. It's amazing that this entire parallel industry exists within our own country that we don't think about, talk about, or know about for the most part.
But
does being Canadian ever come up in New York? Like ever? When you send in a script and you've got you in color, they send it back and they're like, oh, you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's that. There's the editing nightmare. But also the fact that I put our prime minister in a comic.
You did do that, didn't you?
Yeah.
Wow. I had blocked that out.
Yeah. Which was super funny. mostly because I know like it got back to him. Like it was an editorial cartoon, I think, in Ottawa Citizen about the fact that I put him in a comic. Like it became like a weird news story. So he's like, oh, there's a Canadian superhero team, we're doing like a little comic, you know, you want to do something? I'm like, yeah, can I put the prime minister in? Because he was just elected. So it was kind of like that perfect moment where like he hasn't fucked up just yet. And so I had him as like a sparring partner in a boxing ring with Tony Stark, because he had to like, in the issue I was doing, he had to like make a decision about like an international situation involving these superheroes. And I'm like, well, what would Trudeau do in this moment? Like, it was really weird to kind of like figure out kind of what he would say in the situation and hope he doesn't get mad that I gave him a stance that he wouldn't normally take.
And you did good, apparently, because you didn't get like an angry letter back.
No, right? No, the superheroes were making a pipeline and he was like, you just go for it. That's your Canada Land. You can reach Jesse at jesse@canadalandshow.com if you have any comments, concerns, complaints. Canada Land is on Twitter, @CanadaLand. Their website is at canadalandshow.com. This episode is produced by Ali Graham. I'm very sorry, Ali. Our managing editor is Kevin Sexton. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. If you like what Canada Land does, please support them on Patreon.
Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures. And it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.